Jeffrey Canada, the founder and leader of the Harlem Children's Zone, is one of education reform's best known and most respected heroes. A child of the streets of the South Bronx, he created what might be the most intense, most integrated effort ever to combat poverty in one of the nation's poorest communities. In whatever it takes, Jeffrey Canada's quest to change Harlem and America, New York Times Magazine editor Paul Tough takes readers into the heart of the Children's Zone and into the passion and logic of Jeffrey Canada. We talk with Paul about Canada's vision, the role that the Promise Academy charter schools are playing, and the evidence about whether the zone is working to transform Harlem and the children who live there. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us via Skype.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, well, we're very much looking forward to talking with you about the book, which is just an excellent piece of journalism and very compelling to read. I also want to get your insights about what's happened to Jeffrey Canada and to the Harlem Children's Zone and to education reform since the book came out in 2008, which now feels like a long time ago. But first, let's talk about your experience with this. Tell us, how did you come to write a book about Jeffrey Canada and the Harlem Children's Zone?
It started all the way back in 2003, which now really feels like a long time ago. And I'd read a couple of brief references to the Harlem Children's Zone in small articles in the New York Times that just mentioned that he was doing this experiment and taking 24 blocks in Harlem and trying to change outcomes for all of the kids in that neighborhood. And that sounded like a different enough and promising enough intervention to me that I was intrigued, at least. So I called him up to see if I could do an interview with him. I was working as an editor at the New York Times Magazine at the time and writing some for the magazine. And that was back in the days when you could actually call up Jeffrey Canada and go to see him. The Harlem Children's Zone is a little smaller than it is now. So I went up and did one interview with him in the summer of 2003. And by the end of talking to him for an hour, I was convinced that I wanted to write an article about him. Just hearing, you know, hearing his story, hearing his background, hearing his ideas, it was really powerful. So I spent a year working on the article. It came out in 2004. And when I got to the end of the article, I felt like his story in lots of ways was just beginning rather than coming to an end, because his charter school was just about to open. And so I wound up spending another 3-4 years reporting the book and writing it.
Very good. Did you have a background in studying poverty? Was this an issue that you'd looked at for much of your career?
It wasn't, no. I mean, a couple of other articles that I wrote sort of were tangentially connected to poverty. But no, it was there was a lot that I had to learn when I started talking to Jeff. And I mean, in some ways, it was definitely a disadvantage. There was a lot that you know, he would make reference to that I'd have to then run home and look up and, you know, get books out of the library and bone up on. But in some ways, I think it was an advantage. It gave me this opportunity to come to these big subjects kind of new and fresh. And it meant I had to do a lot of reading, but it let me sort of understand the full context behind things.
Yeah. Let me ask kind of a writer's question here. You decided to write the book about Jeffrey, in large part. Why did you make that choice instead of, say, writing about the Children's Zone more generally, or writing a book about poverty that mentioned him? Why make it such a personal narrative?
Well, I mean, from my point of view, the book is really a combination of those things, and that definitely was in terms of the writing decisions I made, putting the book together. That was a big part of what I was thinking about, how to combine his story and the story of the zone, and the context in terms of, you know, politics and history and the economics that surrounded the Harlem Children's Zone. But, you know, there are pretty some sections of the book where he just disappears, where it felt like just spending time with the people in the zone was the right thing to do. But I felt like his story was powerful enough, and his own, I mean, it really is an institution that is motivated, I think, by his own quest. But having him as that character that ran through the whole thing seemed like something that made sense to me structurally, but also I thought that readers would really connect with.
Yeah, I think that's right. All right, well, so let's talk about Canada. First of all, his background. Here's this kid from the South Bronx. He ends up going to college at Bowdoin and then running now one of the most famous nonprofit organizations in the country. Tell us, what was his childhood like?
It was pretty rough. It was pretty rough. I mean, definitely in terms of the reporting, one of the most, the best part of reporting the book was these several months that I just spent talking to Jeff and getting him to tell his whole life story. And he really didn't pull punches when he told the story of his youth. He didn't try and sugarcoat it at all. He grew up with a single mother who was sometimes on welfare, sometimes working minimum wage jobs. Actually got kicked off welfare when Jeff's brother inadvertently told a welfare official that she was working and basically cheating on welfare at the time. And Jeff was a very tough kid. He loved the streets. He loved the gang guys who were a little older than him on the streets. Wound up getting in a lot of fights, smoking pot and getting drunk at a very early age. And through a couple of the way, what he describes as lucky breaks, he managed to escape from that milieu in the South Bronx. Although, you know, in lots of ways, he never quite escaped it. But he ended up spending the end of his high school career living with his grandparents on Long Island. And from there, got again through a series of accidents, got to Bowdoin College in Maine. And it was really there that he decided, you know, this is my life's mission. I'm going to become a serious student. I'm going to change the world.
And he goes on to start a nonprofit organization that does a bunch of social service programs. He wasn't satisfied with that, was he?
No. So before the Harlem Children's Zone became the Harlem Children's Zone, it was called the Reeland Centers for Families and Children. And it was like lots of community-based nonprofits all over the country. It ran a whole bunch of good, well-meaning programs targeting lots of different neighborhoods, lots of different stages of life. There was a seniors program, a job training program, some programs for kids. And it just felt to him like it was not making enough of a difference. And that was really where the Harlem Children's Zone idea came from, that he felt sure it's helping a few kids. It's helping the kids who I can touch directly, but it's not really changing the neighborhood. It's not changing things in a big way. And so that was when he decided two things. One is Harlem and the other was children, that he was going to stick with this, what was then a 24 block neighborhood, and pour all of his services into that neighborhood. And that he was going to focus just on children, that he would provide services to parents, but only as vehicles for their children's success. He was going to really do some triage in terms of the services he provided. Anything that was going to help his kids succeed, he would do. Anything else got cut.
And the vision was that this was all going to be very intense and that it was all going to be coordinated, right? The sort of a conveyor belt from birth through college.
Yeah, although one of the things that's striking about the history of how it came together is that, I mean, in some ways, I think it was a fully formed vision from the beginning. But it's the history of the project is really the history of a series of realizations that what he was doing wasn't working well enough and that he needed to do more. And so it started as, he wasn't running a school. He was working with existing public schools. He was doing some early childhood stuff, but not a full conveyor belt. And in lots of ways, this idea of the conveyor belt, I think, didn't really come along until the time that I was reporting, until, 2005, 2006, when he really started weaving the different parts of the program more tightly together.
Now, I have to say, Paul, when you read this and you hear your report and you say, okay, the idea is to bring all these different programs together, to coordinate them, to focus on, say, if you're going to help kids, you got to help the whole neighborhood. You've got to do it, sort of from birth through college. I mean, exciting ideas, but they don't sound particularly, breakthrough. I mean, it seems like common sense, right? That really nobody else was doing this before? Nobody else had tried this?
Nobody else had tried it quite the way that he tried it. Definitely people had tried comprehensive community initiatives. I think the two things that were different. Well, one was once he started running a school, I think that was unique. I don't think anyone has really combined running a charter school with providing a full range of wraparound services. But I think the other idea that was really new was this idea of sort of intense market penetration. That I feel like there's kind of a tradition, is not quite the right word, but a tradition in social services that what you do is you go into a neighborhood and you offer services. And what Jeff wanted to do was be more be more intensive about it. Go door to door, get people, grab people off the street and get them into his programs, give them incentives to show up. That he felt like if you were just offering programs to the families who were willing to show up, you would get the best prepared families. And I think that's what happens with lots of these programs in lots of neighborhoods. But if he felt you were willing to go the extra mile and really recruit people and try and get those families that don't show up for these sorts of programs, then you can really start to affect the kids who most need the help and really start to change the way the whole neighborhood functions.
Right, because you can't think of these kids as isolated. I mean, if you're going to have an impact on one child, you got to have an impact on their friends and their neighbors. And that gets you to this point where you want to get the whole neighborhood engaged in this process. So you do a nice job in part of the book where you describe some of the thinking on poverty and describe how that's changed over time. Could you take us through that a little bit? What was the conventional wisdom when Jeff Canada came along, and how is that changing?
Well, it's definitely gone through a few different phases. I mean, in lots of ways, I trace the history back to the war on poverty. You could start earlier or you could start later. But I feel like that was this moment when the country was focused on poverty in this very intensive way. And certainly the government was focused on it in this intensive way. But I think that the understanding of poverty at the time was pretty simplistic. It was just that poor people didn't have enough money. And so what the government should do is provide money for poor people. And it was a little more complicated than that. And the services were a little more complex. But in large measure, it was just this idea that if you raise people above the poverty line, things would work better for them. After 10 or 20 years of that, the backlash against that, I think, came through Charles Murray's book, Losing Ground, which argued that those sorts of war on poverty programs for families were not only not doing any good, they were doing harm. They were creating this culture of welfare dependence. There was more back and forth through the 70s and the 80s, mostly between Charles Murray and William Julius Wilson, about really what was causing the underclass, the in sort of intense dysfunction and poverty that was not only staying, but I think becoming worse in inner cities across the country. And when Jeff arrived, you know, when he really started working in Harlem, he wasn't thinking about schools at all. He was working at a moment of such chaos when really the main issue was violence. It was the era of crack and lots of guns in inner cities. And he was just trying to keep kids in his programs from being killed. And his first book is all about violence. It wasn't about education at all. And it was only after he spent several years working on violence and after things started to change in New York and the murder rates started to go down all over the city, but especially in neighborhoods like Harlem, that he could start to think more broadly about, well, what do these kids really need? And that was when I think he started thinking about education as a route for them to a better way of life.
Okay, great. We're talking with Paul Tough, the author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Back here with Paul Tough, the author of Whatever It Takes. So, Paul, we were just talking about poverty and different thinking around poverty. And Jeffrey Canada's thinking that where he realized that education was such a key component and something that he needed to focus on. Related to that was the idea that families mattered a whole lot and that you couldn't ignore what was going on in the home and the way that parents were doing their job as parents. So what did Jeffrey try to do about that?
Yeah, I think you're right. That was and is a big debate in education and poverty. And I think what was unique about Jeff's answer was he said, yeah, both of these things are important. There were people who said it's education, people who said it's family. He said it's both. And so that, I think that's a big part of why he chose such a comprehensive approach, that he wanted to fix what was going on within the school walls. He felt like in neighborhoods like Harlem, schools were much worse than they were a few miles further downtown. The less effective teachers were there. The school system as a whole wasn't paying attention to those schools. But at the same time, he also thought that the kids were coming into school much less well prepared, and that had a lot to do with their neighborhood, and it also had a lot to do with their families. And so he began to introduce and has continued to introduce programs that work directly with families, trying to use them as vehicles to improve the chances of their kids. And the main way that he does that is through this program, Baby College, which starts with parents, in some cases, before their kids are even born.
Yeah, tell us what that's like.
Baby College is, well, I mean, as a reporter, it was definitely my the most fun and intriguing and interesting part of what I got to see in Harlem. It is a 9-week parenting program that runs every Saturday morning, and about 100 parents enroll in each session. There are 4 sessions a year. And the parents learn a lot of sort of nuts and bolts stuff about parenting. There's one class about healthcare and immunizations, another about safety, you know, some of the basic information about how to keep your child safe and healthy. But the two biggest components are about brain development and discipline. Brain development, the big messages were to read and play and sing and interact with your child as much as possible, trying to give parents this idea that they are their child's first teacher and most important teacher, and that they can make a huge difference in how the child enters kindergarten. And then discipline, and the big message there was trying to convince parents that corporal punishment was not going to be the most productive method. The discipline classes were always my favorite ones to sit in. I went through Baby College a few times because there was just such a disagreement at the beginning of those discipline classes between what the parents thought and what the instructors were trying to convince them of. The parents were almost, I think, unanimously had experienced corporal punishment as kids themselves, and that was just what made sense to them. And they thought that this message was kind of nuts. And one of the things that I think is most important about Baby College is that it doesn't feel like lecturing. Like, it doesn't feel like just instructors giving information. There is a lot of back and forth. And so there were, you know, it was really intense dialogues about discipline. And there were lots of classes that I went to where the parents, you know, were doing their best to convince the instructor that the instructor was wrong, and not the other way around. So I think it did change things for a number of parents, but that question of corporal punishment versus other styles of discipline remained a very contentious one.
And such a personal issue, right? I mean, there's not many instances in our society where parents get together and really talk about what goes on inside their homes and how do they approach these challenges with their kids. You know, you talk in the book about the research that Annette Leroux has done. Tell us a little bit about that research. And again, did this have some influence on the way that Jeff designed his program?
So Annette Leroux is a sociologist who did this very intensive study of a series of families with kids, trying to understand better how low-income families, working-class families, and professional families raise their kids. And I don't think that literally it had an effect on Jeff. I don't think it was a book that he read or the people who were working on Baby College read. But I do think that a lot of the ideas behind Baby College are similar to the ones that Annette Leroux talks about. And she says that there are these two different styles of parenting in America. The upper class, upper middle class, a middle class version she calls concerted cultivation, and the one that is used in communities like Harlem she calls natural growth. And she describes them as different in almost every way, different in terms of language, different in terms of discipline. But in concerted cultivation, there's a lot more negotiation, there's a lot more conversation. Children are treated more as equals. They're expected to be involved in all sorts of conversations. They're expected to deal with adults in a not in a deferential way, but in a very engaged way. And that's very different than the natural growth approach, which is much more sort of old-fashioned American childhood. It's about, you know, running around with your cousins and not having any adults around at all and playing for hours alone outside the house. And she talks about how in the way that the country is set up right now, concerted cultivation leads to more success, that the way that, you know, university admissions are set up and the job market is set up, learning the kind of skills that you learn in a concerted cultivation childhood, it pays off in this big way. And so I think that that did have, I don't know if it had a lot to do, but it definitely had something to do with the way that Baby College was trying to, the messages that it was trying to impart. I mean, the reason that I waver a little bit about that is that one of the things that I think was so important about Baby College and that I think distinguishes it from some other parenting programs is it really wasn't trying to turn these parents into middle-class white parents. It was, you know, everyone in these Baby College sessions, all the parents, but also all the instructors were African-American or Hispanic and almost all African-American. Most of the instructors were from similar backgrounds, from neighborhoods, mostly African-American neighborhoods in New York. And so it felt like it was about trying to improve outcomes for kids without changing the culture of Harlem. It was a very sort of complicated road that they were walking. But I don't think necessarily that they were trying to push parents towards being more like these Annette Leroux concerted cultivation parents.
Fascinating. All right, well, let's talk about the school. So shortly after Joel Klein becomes chancellor in New York City, he meets with Canada, and Joel Klein gives him some very strange advice coming from a new chancellor who runs the public school system. What did he tell him?
He told him to start a charter school. Yeah, so Jeff had already been working with lots of schools in Harlem, providing after-school programs and some in-class tutors. And when he first sat down to meet with Klein, he had this idea, well, maybe we could do a partnership with the school system. We could work out some arrangement where, you know, we control 51% or you control 51%. And you're right, Joel Klein said, nope, I don't want to be involved. I'll give you the support you need. I'll try and find you buildings. But you should just start a charter school. And now that doesn't seem like such strange advice, knowing what we do about Joel Klein. But at the time, you know, in I guess it was 2002, 2003, That seemed radical, and I don't think Jeff knew a lot about charters at the time. But he applied for one and got one, and then another, and now runs Promise Academy 1 and Promise Academy 2, both of which are on their way to being K-12 schools in Harlem.
So your opening scene in the book is a charter school lottery, the Harlem Promise Academy lottery. Tell us about that. What was that scene like?
It was intense. So it was the first time I'd been to a charter school lottery, and it was the first time I think that anyone in that room had. They were still pretty new at the time, and this was the first lottery of the first class of the Promise Academy. So they were selecting a kindergarten class and a sixth grade class because they were going to start both the elementary school and the middle school simultaneously. And you know, now I think people who've seen Waiting for Superman are aware that charter school lotteries are intense and heartbreaking experiences. But at the time, I don't think, certainly I didn't realize it showing up, and I don't think the parents or even Jeff had quite realized that, you know, the essential fact of a charter school lottery is that you're going to have more people unhappy than happy. And that was what happened. So the first half hour or so was very exciting. There were about twice as many people there as there were, or families there as there were slots. And the people who got picked were overjoyed and came up to the front and met Jeff and shook his hands and went off to have their picture taken, and there was a real celebratory atmosphere. And then they got to the families that weren't going to get in, and the further they went down the line, they ended up calling names all the way to the very end of the waiting list. But the further they went down the line, the less likely it became that they were ever going to get off the waiting list. And there were families that were really angry at Jeff, really upset with him. And needless to say, you know, being the guy he is, he took it really hard. I mean, here he was trying to do more and more for these families. And at the end of the night, he just felt like, you know, I'm still not doing enough. I think that's this kind of constant refrain for him. I'm sure it's still the way he feels now.
Wow. That's amazing. So the school starts with kindergartners and sixth graders, as you say, a somewhat fateful decision. What ends up happening with the middle school?
Well, the middle school really struggled. So in the book, in three chapters, I chronicle their first 3 years, and they were definitely rough years in the middle school. For a few different reasons that we can talk about. But by the end of those 3 years, Jeff felt like he had to really retool things, and he made a very dramatic decision at the end of the third year to not graduate those eighth grade kids, the kids who were selected in that first lottery, not to move them on to the high school that he had promised to create, but instead to graduate them, as he put it, or kick them out, as they put it, to send them into the process that every New York City middle school kid has to go through, finding a decent high school to go to. And decided to retool the school over the next year or two, and to wait until he felt like things were working better before he started the high school.
And now that's a big deal. I mean, he had made these promises at that original lottery that we will do whatever it takes for your kid to succeed. There must have been a lot of bitterness about that decision to not start the high school in time for those kids to benefit.
There was. I mean, I think, you know, part of it was just a logistical problem that he waited until pretty late in the game to make that announcement. I mean, to make that decision and then that announcement. And so it was, you know, it was a real scramble for those parents and those families to find good schools for their kids. He and his staff did do a lot of work to try to get kids into good schools. They you know, use their connections and try to offer all sorts of support to try to get kids into good schools. And for the most part, they did get into good schools, Catholic schools, and decent high schools around the city. But there were certainly a lot of families who were very mad. I was there on the day that Jeff made that announcement to the students and then to the parents. And yeah, there were people crying and yelling and walking out. And I mean, I think, you know, just as at the lottery, I think that one of the things that tends to temper people's anger is that they realize that, you know, Jeff's more upset with himself than anyone is with him in situations like that. And he just felt awful. I mean, he we're talking about the two, probably, you know, two of the worst experiences he had, which he foolishly invited me to both of them. But you know, he felt pretty bummed out after that lottery. But it didn't compare at all to the way that he felt the day that he made that decision about the high school. He just felt terrible.
Okay, we're talking with Paul Tough, the author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. We'll be back after a short break.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Lots has happened since the book came out. Tell us, how is the Harlem Children's Zone doing? How are the schools doing?
The schools are doing better, for sure. I mean, the elementary school is the school that I've always been most interested in and remain most interested in, just because it is, to me, the best expression of what Jeffrey Canada is trying to build, this program that starts really early, that gets kids on a constant conveyor belt through early childhood programs into preschool, into a K-12 school. And their test results that I've seen from the elementary school have been uniformly really good. You know, test results in New York State have been weird the last few years as they were recalibrated. And so the last couple of years, numbers are harder to track exactly how they're doing. But on the whole, the elementary school has been doing well, not only, you know, in terms of what you can see as a visitor, but in terms of what their test scores are. The middle school, so as we were talking about, its first 3 years were rough in terms of both the tenor of the school and its test scores. After that, the scores improved, but again, when things were recalibrated in New York State, they remained a little bit shaky. So I would, to my sense of the middle school is that it is kind of at the low end of the top tier of charter schools. Mm-hmm. It's not one of the sort of super elite charter schools that gets those remarkable test results every year, but it is definitely a well-functioning one.
So what's the evidence on the Harlem Children's Zone as a whole? Is this working? There was one Brookings paper that came out that indicated that it, you know, these wraparound services don't seem to be adding much, and at least in terms of student achievement compared to other charter schools in New York. Have there been other studies? How do we know whether this stuff actually works?
Well, I wouldn't quite say we don't know, but it's pretty close to we don't know. I mean, it's a problem with this kind of intervention is that it is really hard to get results. And I mean, I really objected to that Brookings report and to some other reports that have made similar points that have said, you know, because of what I just said, that the Harlem Children's Zone School is not in the top of the top tier, it must not be as good a program as the schools that are in the top tier. And, you know, this gets to some pretty big questions in the education reform debate. But I think that I think that drawing that kind of conclusion from the evidence that we have is really premature and is not supported by what's out there right now. So I don't, you know, there aren't numbers that you can point to. They're not doing, you know, there's no sort of 98 blocks right next to the Harlem Children's Zone that isn't getting any services or that's only getting schools that they can use as a control group. But what I think we're beginning to see in the elementary school and what I think we'll continue to see is when you combine schools with outside services, you're going to get a much more effective set of results, and that they're going to be more universal. That again, it's a huge debate in education reform, but I think that the schools that are highest performing do tend to are less able to get the kids that Jeffrey Canada is trying to target, are less able to get the kids at the very bottom of the distribution of advantage and disadvantage. And I think that his case is that's great. Hitting kids in the, you know, sort of 20 to 40% area of the bell curve is really important, and getting them to high levels of success is miraculous in the schools that are able to achieve that. That's great. But that's never going to transform a neighborhood or a whole school system or outcomes for poor kids as a whole. And that if you want to get there, you need something that's much more comprehensive, that really goes out of its way to recruit the families and the kids who are struggling the most, and that tries to affect the whole tenor of a neighborhood as well as individual kids' scores. And that stuff's hard to measure. It doesn't show up in middle school test scores right away the way that you know, really high performing charter schools can show results, you know, a year after they open. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I don't think that fact detracts from both the importance of that kind of intervention and the promise of that kind of intervention.
Right. And so when will we know? It's still, a few years until that original kindergarten class will be going off to college and we can see how many make it to college?
I mean, I think that'll be the ultimate result. I mean, I think, you know, in lots of ways, I feel like, and I know that this is not, you know, according to the Brookings report, this is not the way you should make public policy. But I mean, I think that the real promise of the Harlem Children's Zone is in Promise Neighborhoods, is in this program that President Obama suggested before he was president, and that is in a halting kind of way coming out of the Department of Education. If it is able to, and the Promise Neighborhoods, the idea is to replicate the Harlem Children's Zone in cities all over the country. If that is able to start to happen, I think the two things will happen. One is I think that people will improve on Jeffrey Canada's methodology. I think that he, you know, there's lots about the Harlem Children's Zone that works perfectly, but I think that there are lots of improvements that can be made, and I think that other cities will start to figure that out. I think lots of them will fail along the way, but I think some of them will start to figure that out. And I think that we'll start to get a broader kind of evidence as well. And that will be in all kinds of metrics, some of which I think we've figured out and some of which we haven't yet. Some of that will be absolutely high school graduation, college matriculation, and college graduation. But I think ideally it'll also be in things like crime rates, economic development, housing in neighborhoods, health outcomes in neighborhoods. I think that all of those things are equally important metrics when you're talking about the lives of poor kids.
So since you wrote this book, Jeffrey Canada has become something of a household name. Of course, he was one of the stars of Waiting for Superman. I believe I've seen him in American Express ads, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, you have.
So what is life like for Jeffrey Canada these days, and sort of what's next for him?
I don't know as well as I used to what life is like for Jeffrey Canada. I mean, I think I sort of have a feeling that in lots of ways it's not that different than it was. I mean, I think he is, he has a higher and higher profile, and I think he's, you know, using it to try to leverage more resources for the Harlem Children's Zone. I think that he's increasingly focused on promised neighborhoods and trying to figure out how to keep that program alive and make it more viable than it is now. But I think in lots of ways, what he's doing is the same thing that he was always doing. And he, you know, he tries hard not to micromanage. But when I was interviewing him, you know, there would still be individual fights between two kids in the middle school who would end up in his office because it was decided that he was the one who could properly adjudicate this. And I have a feeling that kind of thing is probably still happening today.
Wow, that's great. What's next for you, Paul? What are you working on as your next project?
Well, I'm working on a new book that is due to come out in 2012. And in some ways, I think of it as an expansion of the Harlem Children's Zone book. That when I got to the end of my reporting for that book, I still felt like there were some big questions that I had that went beyond the Harlem Children's Zone about what do we really know about which kids succeed and why. This debate over, you know, what is it that helps a poor kid succeed? Is it school? Is it family? Is it neighborhood? There are lots of opinions about that, but there, until recently anyway, I don't think have been a lot of hard facts. And so I've spent the last couple of years looking at a lot of different research from neuroscience to economics to psychology about what is going on in child development, in brain development, in neighborhood function that is affecting whether kids succeed or don't succeed. And I'm also looking at a number of different interventions that are trying to use some of this research to improve chances for kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a great sequel for sure. Paul, thank you for your time today. Again, Paul Tough, the author of Whatever It Takes, Jeffrey Canada's Quest to Change Harlem and America. Paul, we enjoyed having you on the program, and we hope you'll come back when your next book is out.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Nation X Book Club is Marcy Canstrom. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education X Book Club.